Fight. That was the only answer. I could hardly just smile and claim to be lost. If I was quick enough and didn't get entangled in the cam net, I could threaten them with the bow. No, that wouldn't work. I would just make a run for it and hope they weren't carrying. I mentally checked that all the important stuff was in my pockets. They stopped. They exchanged a few more words. Then Men in Black took a last drag on his cigarette, dropped it on the ground near his feet, and stubbed it out with the toe of his trainer. He obviously hadn't read the signs asking him to leave only footprints. They turned right, about 10 meters short of my position, moving uphill towards the track. They were taking the easy route as the ground right next to the house was steeper. Tooth into Wind led the way. They walked up onto the track, and I realized that they were checking the ground. They were looking to see if there was any sign left by anyone during the night. They moved off the track and downhill, but stopped short of the house and didn't move any closer to it. I wondered why, and then I realized there must be proximity alarms, as well as the motion detectors which would trigger the lights. There must be sensors that informed them of movement outside. Judging by the route the two of them took, I worked out that the proximity alarms were probably covering an area about 12 to 15 meters out from the house. MIB lit up again as they went back onto the track, then disappeared behind the house, still playing with his beads. I used the time to check the cam, the bung behind me, and that my pockets were done up. After 4 minutes, I watched them emerge from the opposite side of the house, the lakeside, and walk towards the boat on the trailer. They clambered aboard and started up the engine, revving it until I could see the blue two-stroke smoke pumping out of the exhaust. Then, just as suddenly, they killed it, and jumped out with lots of talking as they disappeared through the gap between the garage doors. I heard the wagon start up. It wasn't going anywhere because the boat was in the way. It meant these boys were good. They were checking everything, including their getaways in the event of a drama. The vehicle engine cut and there was silence. They didn't re-emerge. I now knew there were at least two in the house, and I also knew that there must be access to the house from the garage. That was it for another couple of hours. I just lay there, watching, resting one eye at a time. Now and again, I could hear a putt-putt on the lake, and a couple of times the sound of a toilet flushing. Occasionally there was the far-off screaming of kids, possibly in a boat or playing in the water, but otherwise nothing unusual. At 10:15, I watched as Mom, Dad and kids from the other house started to push another boat towards the lake. That was probably them out of it for the day. Well, until it rained anyway. After that, nothing at all happened. It was pizza and Mars bar time. At about 11:30, I started to get movement from the garage doors. Still nibbling at the last bit of my third Mars bar, I moved my thumb over the cable release. MIB came out. I watched him and slowly swirled the camera to the right, wishing I had a wider lens. He walked to the front of the trailer and stopped near the hookup point. He seemed to be waiting. Sure enough, the wagon sparked up. Sarah walked out. Gotcha. She was wearing blue jeans and a blue sweatshirt, with the Quicksilver logo on the back. I knew her gait. I even recognized her walking boots. She stopped to look at the sky. Yes, it was going to rain. I hit the cable release and hoped I'd got her. If so, the job was just about over. It felt so strange, seeing her after so long, and in this way. She still looked just like the picture in her apartment, but without the smile. It gave me a strange sense of power over her by being hidden, watching. As the boat was in the way, the garage doors couldn't open fully. She and MIB twisted the boat so that it was parallel to the water, Then they opened the garage doors fully, and out came a black Ford Explorer. One up. It was too thin to win, and, going by what I could see of his top half, he'd smartened himself up. Probably had a shit shower and shave. The engine revved as he came screaming towards me, then uphill towards the track. I craned my head in an attempt to catch the registration. I couldn't get any detail, but it definitely had a North Carolina plate with the First in Flight slogan and a picture of the Wright brothers' aircraft on a white background. My eyes jumped back to Sarah. She was helping to turn the boat round so that it faced the water again, ready to go. This was an escape route for sure. Once they had done that, they went inside and the garage doors were closed fully behind them. Very weird shit. It seemed that London were right to worry about her after all. Chapter 11. I slowly got out the 3C and slid open one of the ports, inserted a flashcard from my jeans pocket and turned it on. A flashcard stores information in much the same way as a floppy disk does for a PC. What came up on the screen from this one was a selection of about 200 words or phrases, each with a 5-figure sequence of numbers beside it. The letters of the alphabet were also encoded, so that uncommon words could be spelled out. To compose my message, all I had to do was scroll through to the word or phrase I wanted and write down the corresponding 5-figure group on my notepad with a pencil. I preferred pencils to pens, because you can write with them in the rain. I always used one that was sharpened at both ends, so that if one lead broke, I could still use the other. The first part of the message I was going to send was standard and didn't need the codes. My PIN was 2442. But, since the numbers had to be in groups of 5 for the code to work, I made it 02442. I followed this with the time-date groups. 02604, 26th of April. I had a look at Baby G and wrote down 01156, 11:56 hours. Times are always local. It was then just a matter of scrolling through the codes to make up the message. The first I looked for was TGT lock, 6-fig grid. I gave the map sheet details, plus the 6-figure grid reference of the target. Just to make it clear, I told them that it was the easternmost building of the two. My message continued. Echo 1, Sarah, located with 2 Bravos, males, Middle Eastern, are aware. No weapons, MAC down, waiting further instructions. I ended the message with my PIN again. 02442. And that was it. It worked out that I had 21 groups of numbers. I put the second flashcard into port B, took out A, and put it back in my jeans pocket. I could run the Cyan with both cards in, but I didn't like doing it. If there was a drama and I was caught, it meant the whole system would be accessible all at once. At least, with them separated, I had the chance to hide or destroy a key part of it. The second card held a series of numbers also in groups of 5, called the One-Time Pad. Devised by the German diplomatic service during the 1920s, the OTP is a simple encoding method consisting of a random key used only once. There are a few variations on the OTP theme. The Brits first started using it in 1943. Still widely used by the intelligence services of all countries, it is the only code system that is unbreakable, both in theory and in practice. I started by writing down in my notebook the first group from the OTP under the first group of the message, my PIN. I carried on until all 21 groups had another set of numbers from the one-time pad under them. What I had to do then was subtract 14735, the first group of the OTP, from 02442, my identification code, and came up with 98717. not because my maths was shit, but because in Spyland sums, you don't carry the 10 over, you lose it. Bloody typical. At the London end, they knew the message would start with my pin, and groups are always used in the order they are laid out in. It would be easy for them to add the groups on their corresponding OTP from the groups that I'd transmitted. And they'd come up with the original set of numbers again, because they would also do Spyland sums. Referring these back to the codebook, they'd produce my intended word or phrase. Once used, those groups would never be issued again. I did my spy-type sums one more time to confirm my arithmetic, and was ready to send. I turned on the phone, tapped in the PIN code and waited for a signal. I tapped out K's on the sign to retrieve Elizabeth's number. I hadn't got round to learning it after all. After two rings, a recorded message from a synthesized but happy-sounding female voice said, "Please leave your message after the tone." 2 seconds later, there was a beep. I tapped out the message of 21 groups on the number pad, then pressed hash and listened for the auto-acknowledgement. "Thank you for your..." There was a pause, then a different electronic voice. 21 group. Then the original voice. "Message." It cut off, and so did I. I put the flashcards back in their separate jeans pockets. I wrapped the piece of paper up in a sheet of cling film and tucked it under a branch in the mud. I didn't want to get rid of it yet, because I didn't know if I was going to need it. If London came back and told me they couldn't work out my message, it might be because I'd fucked up the encoding or spy sums. The system can be time-consuming, but used properly, it works. The next part of the job was to Mac down the pictures. I plugged the lead into the phone, clipped it into the receiver end of the camera, and clicked on its internal modem. I dialed the same London number and got the same recorded message. I pressed send on the camera. The telephone was taking the information from the digital camera and bouncing it off a satellite up there somewhere. Pictures would come up on an Apple Mac screen at the other end, and hard copies would be made. Within minutes, Elizabeth and Lynn would have my nice holiday snaps of Sarah and her two playmates on their desks. After transmission, I switched off the phone to save the battery. It was pointless leaving it on. They weren't going to get back to me straight away. If they did, the phone's message service would intercept the call anyway, so no problems. I was in no rush. Even if they said, "End X." I couldn't come out of here until nightfall. Events had moved on since my briefing. I tried to imagine what would be going on in London. Elizabeth would probably be at home, as it was the weekend. A car would be sent to her country seat to bring her to the operations room in Northolt, North London. The opening scene of James Bond's Tomorrow Never Dies with large screens and computer projections on VDUs wasn't that far from the truth. The people receiving my int wouldn't have a clue what it was about or who it was from. Elizabeth would lock herself away with Lynn somewhere and look at it, probably complaining that it had taken me so long, and then drink some more tea. From what I could remember, it seemed very fashionable to drink a herbal blend at the moment. But not her. She'd be throwing Earl Grey down her neck. Meanwhile, I waited out in this hole. Elizabeth, not Lynn, would make the decision on what I was to do next. I wished again that I knew who she was. I hated it when people had so much power over me, and I didn't know who had given it to them or why. I had my fingers crossed that they wouldn't want a technical device put in to find out who these people were and what they were up to, because that would entail me doing a CTR, close target reconnaissance, to help whoever was being sent to do the job. That would mean getting into the house and working out the best way to bring the technical device in, as well as describing the makeup of the general area, the size of the house, how many stories, the kind of doors, the kind of locks. A locks recce is a task in itself. It means going right up to the door or window to study them in detail. Sometimes you put a little bit of talcum powder on the lock, then press plasticine into the keyway. Pull it out and put it in a secure container so you can take imprints later. Then, of course, you have to remember to remove all the dust from the lock. A CTR has to answer every conceivable question that might be asked by a third party, who's been tasked with making entry. Are the windows locked? What is the area of clear glass? Of frosted glass? What are the main access routes to and from the target? Is the target overlooked by any buildings? Are there any garages or outbuildings or car parking spaces? How many doors are secured? How many are loose? Do they make a noise when they open? They would need to know to take in some oil to stop any creaking. Are there any good approach routes? Any major obstacles? Is there lighting? What are the weather conditions like? What are the routes to the target? What's the general condition of those routes? What would you need to get to the target? What type of ground? Ploughed, pasture, boggy? What sort of natural obstacles are there? What is the time and distance from the DOP? Drop-off point. Where is the DOP? Are there any animals about? Dogs, horses, geese? And that was assuming I could get onto the target at all, past the proximity lights. The list of questions can seem endless, especially when you're 2 hours into a CTR. First light is approaching, and you only seem to be a third of the way down the list. Where are the best places to put OPs in? In this particular case, that was easy. I was in it. Where would be the best place to put long-range technical devices in for a video soak? That would be somewhere over the other side of the lake. Could we have a helicopter trigger? Could we have a helicopter that just flies around maybe 3 or 4 Ks out? Once I'd gathered all that information on the exterior, I would have to CTR inside the house. For that, I'd need to take in an infrared camera, or buy commercially available infrared filters to fit my camera, so that I could take pictures without disturbing the people in residence. They'd want to know the full estate agent's Monty. What are the dimensions and layouts of every room? Where is the electrical supply? If you're putting listening or picture devices in, batteries only last so long, so you might have to tap into the mains. Where is the best place to put a listening device? And that might entail looking at the direction of the floorboards, because if you're trying to hide an antenna, you'd put it in the gaps between them. But that also means taking a compass bearing of the floorboards, so the scalies, communications personnel, can work out their antenna theory. Stuff like this takes days and days to organise, and it would be my job to stay and wait with eyes on target while everything was prepared. If my stores ran out, I would have to be resupplied via a dead letterbox and outside help. And even that would be a pain in the arse to sort out. As far as I was concerned, my job was now finished. I found Sarah and confirmed it with photography. I didn't want to be a part of anything that happened next. I cut away from it by thinking about a job I'd done in the jungle once. We'd got to our report line. It was pouring down with rain, and we were gagging for a hot brew, which we couldn't sort out because we were on hard routine. We transmitted our sit rep, something to the effect of, "We are at the riverhead. What now?" We were told, "Wait out." About 4 hours later, they came back to us and said, "OP any track." What the fuck did they mean, OP any track? What good would that do us? We asked, "What track?" They came back, "OP any track that runs west to east." They had to be mad. We sent back, "We can't find one running west to east. However, we found one running east to west, and we're going to OP that one." All we got back was, "East-west is good. Out." Either they were taking the piss, or the world's most useless officer was manning the desk that night. We never found out which. You never do. Nothing was happening. Even the fishermen had gone back to their tents for lunch. I'd just decided it was pizza time and was about to reach for one of my wraps when I heard movement on the ground, and soon afterwards, rapid, heavy breathing. The distinctive metallic tinkle of a name tag on a collar became louder as the dog got nearer. I hadn't seen anything around the target that identified it as having a dog, so it probably wasn't from the house. But the name tag meant the animal was domestic, and that meant there would probably be people with it. I began to hear aggressive sniffing. Seconds later, a wet, dirty nose was nudging the hide. Maybe he was a fan of Walmart's Four Seasons. I moved my hand slowly to my pocket, easing out the taser and the pepper spray. I didn't know if the pepper would work on dogs. They can be immune to some of this shit. One thing I knew for sure, he wouldn't enjoy the taser. But then again, the yelping would alert everybody. And what if the shock killed him stone dead? I would have to drag him in with me and have a smelly, wet, and very dead dog as my new best mate. The sniffing seemed just inches from my ear. This dog was excited. It knew it could be Din Din's time. A young woman called,
"Bob? Where are you? Here, Bob."
I recognized the voice. Bob carried on sniffing around the OP. Straight away I thought, I'm a British journalist working for a tabloid newspaper. I'm doing a story on the famous people hiding in the house, and I want to get pictures of their illicit affair. I'll jump straight in with questions before they can ask any. Do you know anything about them? Do you live round here? You could make a lot of money if you tell us what you know about them. The brain has two orbs. One side processes numbers and analyzes information. The other is the creative bit, where we visualize things. And if you visualize situations, you can usually work out in advance how to deal with them. The more you visualize, the better you will deal with them. It might sound like something from a tree hugger's workshop, but it does the business. My eyes were glued to the target, but my ears were with the dog. It's nearly always this sort of third-party shit that compromises you, and dogs can be the worst of all. They can detect your every breath and movement from as much as a mile away under favourable conditions, which it seemed I had given him. Dogs have very poor eyesight, only half as good as man's, but their hearing is twice as good. The wind was blowing from the lake towards the dog. He might have heard me, but I was sure it was an odour that was attracting him. It's not just food smells that provide a target, so does body odour or clothing, especially if it's wet. Soap, deodorant, leather, tobacco, polish, petrol, and many others are all a giveaway. You name it. Who knows what it was in this case? The more Bob sniffed, the more I came to the conclusion that he was after the pizza. No matter how much I'd wrapped it up, his nose wasn't fooled. Cannabis smugglers wrap eucalyptus leaves around their stuff to put off sniffer dogs, but it doesn't work. The mutts can smell both at the same time, and know they're going to get a nice chocolate drop as a reward. I heard a man's voice no more than 20 meters behind me, but I hoped he was in one of the dips.
"Bob? Where are you? Come!"
I recognized his voice as well. I had tripped over these guys last night, and now they were going to return the favour. The girl said,
"Where is he, Jimmy?"
Jimmy was angry.
"I told you we should keep the dog on a fucking leash, man. Or back in the car."
She sounded as if she'd started to cry a little.
"My parents will kill me."
He started to creep.
"It's okay. Bob will be okay, I'm sorry."
I hoped they were more interested in making up than they were in following Bob into my bush. But I was ready. I'd just stick with my tabloid story. They'd be able to see the camera. Besides, if I was a reporter, I wouldn't have told him last night. I'd just have to keep the bow hidden. They obviously had no idea that I was there yet, but Bob did, the nosy little fucker. The girl was still fretting.
I gotta go back. My parents will freak if I'm late with the car, and I've lost Bob.
He wasn't impressed.
Okay, okay, I told you I'd get you home on time.
He sounded pissed off. They could see all hope of a midday knee trembler in the woods evaporating. I heard giggling. He was giving it one last try.
Jimbo, not here. I gotta get home. Bob, come on, boy, let's go.
Bob was having none of it. He was sniffing big time at the OP. Next thing I knew, the dog's face was straight in front of me, demanding his share of the pizza. I gently scooped up a handful of earth and flicked it at his eyes. Bob now thought the pizza man was putting up a fight. He backed off, but not as much as I'd hoped, and started barking. I'd fucked up, but I'd had no choice. As soon as he barked, they knew where he was. The girl must have come over the brow. Her voice was much clearer.
Bob? Oh, look, Jimmy. He's found something. What have you found, Bob?
I got myself ready.
What have you found, boy?
The moment she saw me, I would launch into my reporter's spiel.
What's going on, Bob?
Bob's arse was in the air, his shoulders more or less on the ground with his front legs splayed, and he was jumping back and then coming forward and barking. I kept my eyes on target, and now my ears on her as she started to walk directly towards the hide. I heard the guy shout from somewhere behind me, very pissed off.
Come on, let's go, Bob. Come.
I saw the first floor curtains twitch. Bob was still leaping around with excitement, and on top of that, I heard a vehicle. The tires rumbled along the dirt track. As Bob's nose once again came up to the camnet, I decided to give him the good news with the pepper spray. He jumped back, whelped, and ran to Mommy. I heard the girl.
Bob, see? Serves you right. Stop messing around.
She probably thought he'd got his nose bitten by something. I listened as they shuffled through the sand. Jimmy was still behind somewhere, complaining. Next time they slipped into the woods, he'd lock Bob in the car again to steam up the windows like last night. I got my head back on the ground, watching and listening, just waiting for shit to happen. The Explorer had come back, two up. I looked up just before it turned left off the track and downhill towards the garage. It came down the hill and headed away from me, towards the garage. Tooth Into Win was still in the driver's seat. I couldn't make out his new playmate in the passenger seat. The wagon stopped just short of the garage, and the side door of the house opened. Sarah again. She was looking at the woods behind me, keeping a wary eye out for Bob and his friends. I watched her, and tried to keep contact with her eyes. I would know if she suspected anything. I watched her scan the tree line, uphill and then back down again, towards me. As her eyes approached my OP, I moved mine out of contact. I couldn't look at her. A sixth sense can sometimes let you know when you're being looked at, and I didn't want to take the chance. I knew I was doing the wrong thing. Even if her plan was not to react to anything she saw, but to go back into the house, then return with an automatic weapon to hose down the area, I knew her well enough to see it in her eyes. I could feel sweat running around the back of my legs and neck. I waited 3 or 4 seconds more, then moved my eyes up again. She was finishing off her scan, past me and down to the lake. Once there, she quickly turned her head to the wagon and walked up to the passenger door. A white guy clambered out. By his style of dress, I would say he was American. He was wearing a black nylon bomber jacket, tight blue jeans and white trainers. He was above average height and build, about mid-30s, with black, fairly long curly hair and a moustache, like the sheriff's in the Bugs Bunny cartoons. He looks good enough to be the hunky lumberjack in any soap. The meeting with Sarah was intimate. They hugged, kissed each other on the mouth, then held the embrace. They spoke in low voices as Sarah ran her hand across his back. There was something odd going on, though. They looked pleased to see each other, but the talking wasn't loud, and they weren't going overboard. I got two pictures of them during the 30 or so seconds that they were together. Tooth Into Win had the tailgate down on the Explorer. He was looking quite smart in jeans and a dark check jacket. He pulled out a brown suit carrier with an airline tag on the handle. Sarah disappeared inside the garage with the white guy, followed by Tooth Into Win, who closed the door behind them. It was time to send another sit rep. Chapter 12. I had just started to prepare my message when Tooth Into Win emerged from the side door with MIB. He, too, had had a shit shower and shave, and was dressed a lot smarter in brown trousers and jacket. They both got into the Explorer, Tooth Into Win in the driver's seat. The wagon backed round to point uphill. They weren't talking to each other, smiling, or looking at all happy. Something was happening. The 4x4 bumped along the track and disappeared from sight. I looked back at the house. All the windows and doors were closed, and so were the curtains. That was strange. If someone was arriving at such a nice spot, surely you would show him the view. Maybe she had better things to do with him. Maybe he was just another sucker that she was using. But for what, exactly? It was nearly 2 hours before the Explorer returned. There were bodies in the back, but I couldn't work out how many as it turned downhill. My eyes flicking between the wagon and the side door of the house, waiting for it to open. When it did, it was the American who appeared. Sarah was nowhere to be seen. He was looking aware, checking the lake, and, as MIB had done, playing with worry beads. I watched him, listening to the slow rumble of tires past my OP. His denim shirt tails were hanging out of his jeans and showing below his bomber jacket. I was right. He and Sarah did have better things to do than look at the scenery. The wagon stopped, and I counted an additional 2 heads in the rear seats. All 4 got out, and I pressed the cable release. The 2 newcomers were both dark-skinned. They hugged and kissed the American on both cheeks. It looked as if they knew him pretty well. All the same, there were no loud shouts of welcome or smiles, and everybody spoke in a murmur I couldn't understand. The meeting also seemed to have an air of relief about it. Tooth Into Win and MIB had opened the tailgate and were pulling out 2 square aluminium boxes, which were plastered with what looked like old and torn, fragile stickers and airline security tape. They started to move the boxes inside the garage via the side door. The luggage area of the 4x4 was still full of sports bags, another suit carrier, and a black plastic cylinder which stretched from the back seat to the gear selector at the front. It was about 2 meters long and covered at each end. Either it was the world's biggest poster tube, or they had some serious fishing rods with them. I didn't think. One of the new guys motioned to the other one and the American to give him a hand. I snapped some more. This guy looked much older than the others. He was short and bald, with a very neat black moustache. And he was a bit overweight, mostly around the stomach. He looked like he should be in a film as the gangster boss, the boss man. The other newcomer was more nondescript, of medium build and height, and looked about 20 years old. He could have done with a few plates of what the bald guy had been eating. After a couple of trips, with the boys lifting what seemed to be heavy kit, the 4x4 was empty and everything was stowed inside the garage. The side door closed, and the area once more looked as if nothing had happened all day. What was going on here? Ever since we'd first met, It had seemed to me that Sarah was sympathetic to the Arabs. She'd been involved with them in one way or another for most of her life. Come to think of it, we'd even had a row once about Yasser Arafat. I said that I thought he'd done a good job. She thought he was selling out to the West. "It's all about homeland, both spiritual and cultural, Nick," she'd say every time the subject arose, and nobody who'd been within sight of a Palestinian refugee camp could argue. But I wondered whether there was more to it than that. A faint drizzle was starting. It hadn't penetrated my hide yet, but could clearly be seen falling on the open ground in front of me. I could hear outboard motors in the distance as the intrepid fisherman set out in pursuit of a 6-ounce carp. Lunchtime must be over. There's more to surveillance than just the mechanics. A report that says, 4 men get out of vehicle, 2 men pick up bags and go inside, is all very well. But it's the interpretation of those events that matters. Were they looking aware? Did they seem to know each other well? Were they, perhaps, master and servant? These people were meeting up, in hiding, and with kit. I'd seen this before with ASUs, active service units. The boxes looked as if they'd seen a lot of airtime during their life, but not on this trip. There were no airline tags on the handles or on the bags. Maybe they'd driven to an RV point and then transferred the kit. If so, why? Whatever was happening here, it wasn't about the turtles. Things were starting to spark up, and Lynn and Elizabeth needed to know that there were now 4 Arabs, 1 American, and Sarah. Maybe London could make sense of what was happening. After all, they would know far more than they had told me. With any luck, Elizabeth would now be at Northolt, poring over my previous message and images, with her tea so strong you could stand the spoon in it. It was 15:48. Time to switch on the phone. It had been a couple of hours since my last transmission, and they should be calling me back with an acknowledgement and maybe even a reply. I took it out of my pocket and switched it on, placing it in the shell scrape so I could see when I had a signal while I got out the codes from my jeans and encoded my sit rep. As I retrieved the 3C, I started to feel like I needed a shit. So much for the Imodium. It should have bunged me up, but maybe the combination of pizza, Mars bars and Spam weren't the most binding of materials. I knew from bitter experience that fighting the urge never works. If you've got the time, however inconvenient that might be, you never wait until the last minute. If you do, sure as anything, a drama will occur at the targets the moment you get your trousers down. I got the roll of cling film from the Bergen and pulled off the best part of a meter. Leaning over to my left, still trying to keep my eyes on the target, I undid the buttons of both sets of trousers with my right hand and pulled them down, along with my pants. I then got the cling film in my left hand and tucked it under, ready to receive. I started to want to piss. I wasn't going to rummage for the petrol can at this stage of the proceedings, so I just had to restrain myself while I got the main event out of the way. I wrapped the first handful in the cling film and put it to one side. Pulled off another length, put it underneath and carried on. Having to do this in the field is never an easy procedure, especially when you're lying on your side and in fits and starts, because it's got to be controlled. It's unpleasant, but there's no way round it. The drizzle was now trying hard to become something more grown up. I could hear the first raindrops hitting the leaves above me. I was about halfway through the second lot of cling film when the LED on the phone told me I had a message waiting. At the same moment, I heard a voice, male and American. I switched off the phone and thrust it and the 3C in my pockets. I looked out of the hide at the movement of the trees, trying to gauge the direction of the wind. It was still coming in from the lake. The American was on his own, coming out of the garage doors and heading towards the boat. Trying desperately to control my sphincter and bladder, I watched as he moved the boat out of the way of the garage doors. I guessed he was going to park up the Explorer. He climbed into the driver's seat and revved the engine. All the curtains in the house were still closed, and there was no other sign of movement. There are quite a few times on tasks when you really have no alternative but to shit yourself, especially on urban OPs when you're in a loft space and there are people downstairs. You try not to do it, because you might have to go out into the street straight afterwards and operate like a civilian. But sometimes if there's no room to move, it's just got to be done. The only precautions you can take are to not eat before the op, drink as little as you can, and pop some Imodium. Then hope for the best. It's a bit like the Kit Kat commercial, with a photographer outside the panda house at the zoo. You could have been lying in an OP for 4 weeks, but the moment you get the cling film out, the panda emerges and does a quick impersonation of Fred Astaire. I'd guessed correctly. By now, the 4x4 was in the garage. The boat was back in position, and he'd gone back into the house. I finished off the job with the cling film and petrol container and pulled up my trouser bottoms. I was feeling quite sorry for myself. The only consolation I could think of was that cling film probably did the job better than the shiny stuff in the car park toilets would have done. I tore off another big length of it, wrapped up all my offerings and popped them straight into the Bergen. It would help to hide the smell, which in turn meant it wouldn't attract flies and animals. I then tucked the fuel canister back into the Bergen as well, doing my bit for eco-tourism. I'd learned my lesson. I dug around in the day sack for the Imodium and took another 6 capsules, probably enough to constipate an elephant. I lay down again with my hands resting under my chin, looking at the target, but after a couple of sniffs I decided to rub them with soil and keep them away from my face for a while. On target, nothing else had changed. The curtains were still closed. In the hide, it was now wet and miserable. The rain was starting to fall more heavily, the noise of it hitting the trees increased, and it was dripping from the foliage, through the cam net, and running down my face and neck. I brushed away a small twig which had stuck to my cheek. Sod's Law of OPs was at it again. I knew it would only be a matter of time before it percolated down onto me in a steady stream. I got out the phone again. Sheltering it under my chest, I switched on the power, tapped in my PIN, and dialed K's sweet shop, then *2442. They would be transmitting one-time pad number groups to me, exactly as I'd done to them, except that the groups would have been recorded on a continuous tape, which would keep running until I acknowledged that I had received it. I cradled the phone to my ear and listened as I switched the Scion to word processing mode. As the woman's voice recited groups of 5-digit numbers, I tapped them into the keyboard. It was easier than writing them down.
Group 6, 1, 4, 7, 3, 2. Group 7, 9, 7, 6, 4, 1. Group...
I knew it had got to the end of the message when she said,
Last group, 6, 9, 8, 2, 1. End of message. Press the star key if you require the message repeated.
I did. I then had to wait a few moments for the message to repeat itself so I could receive the first 5 groups. Up it came again.
You have a... pause. Different voice.
16. Back to normal voice.
Group message. Group 1, 6, 1, 4, 7, 6. Group 2.
When the taped message had come full circle, I switched off the phone, put it away and transferred the groups onto paper. I'd never been up to doing the maths on the Scion, and by the time I'd got the hang of it, I would have been up for retirement. The rain was coming down in earnest, keeping my eyes on the house. I pulled the hood up around my neck to cut out what was pouring through the cam net. I couldn't cover my head, however, because that would degrade my hearing. armed with the number groups. I was now going to do the reverse of what I'd done earlier. Look for the recognition group on the one-time pad, then subtract each group from the ones that I had on my OTP. Once I'd done that, I put the flashcard back in my jeans pocket and got out the one that held the codes. They came up on the screen, and I worked out the message. The first lot of groups were the introduction. Date, time groups, all that sort of stuff. Then I got to the meat of the message. 61476, extract. 97641, target. 02345, by any means. 98562, cut off time. 47624, DTG, date, time group, times local. 82624, 27 April. 47382, 0500 hours, times local. 42399, FOR. 42682, T104. 15662, acknowledge. 88765, 02442. Extract target was easy enough to understand. They wanted me to remove Sarah from the house by 5 a.m. tomorrow morning. Fair enough. It was the next bit I couldn't believe. T104. T plus a numeral is a code within a code, for brevity. There are quite a few T commands, and they have to be learned parrot fashion, as nothing about them is ever written down by anyone, anywhere. They don't officially exist, and the reason is simple. T is a command to kill. They wanted me to kill Sarah. Not only that, but 104 meant without trace. The body must never be discovered. Elizabeth must have been more pissed off at being summoned to Northolt on a Sunday than I'd thought. Either that, or they told me even less about the operation than I suspected they had. The wind gusted, and the heavens opened, as if to confirm my feeling about the T-104. Chapter 13. I redialed. The recorded voice said, "You have no new messages." There was a pause. Then she started to give out the introduction for the groups already sent. I checked them against the ones I'd written down and went through all the codes again. As I protected the 3C from the rain, I knew there was no mistake. I took a deep breath and let it go slowly, wiping away some water which had splashed down my cheek. I'd been a young infantryman when I'd killed my first man, an IRA terrorist. I'd felt good about it. I thought that was how you were supposed to feel. After all, it was what the army did for a living. Later, I got more satisfaction from stopping death than causing it. However, if the task was to kill, it didn't particularly worry me. I didn't celebrate the fact, but neither did I complain. I understood that they had sons and daughters, mothers and fathers, but they were players like everybody else, including me. And at its most basic level, if somebody had to die, I'd rather it was them than me. My only concern was to try to make it as quick as possible. Not so much for their benefit, but to make it safer for me. This T-104 was different. This was the second time I'd had to kill someone I'd been close to. Considering there was only Josh left who resembled anything like a friend, I couldn't help wondering what the fuck was going on in my life. Ewan had been my best mate for as long as I could remember. But he'd used me. Worse than that, he'd used Kelly. Now, the only woman I'd ever felt really involved with had got herself into a world of shit that I had to wipe clean. I was starting to feel sorry for myself, and realized it. I had to cut out of this. I needed to get real. I deleted from the flashcard the groups that had been used for the two messages, and ate the small piece of paper I had used. No one would ever be using that combination again. That was why it was called a one-time pad. And no evidence of any T-104 would ever be seen, since all details are destroyed once used. I put the two flashcards back into separate pockets in my jeans and turned off the 3C, getting it out of the rain. Everything that Elizabeth and Lynn had said was making sense to me here on the ground. They knew the big picture, I was sure of it. Maybe the imagery I'd mapped down to them had confirmed their fears. Was there a connection with what she'd got up to in Syria? I didn't even bother to think that much about it. I didn't really give a fuck. Even if, say, this group was planning to hit Netanyahu, Arafat, Clinton, or even the whole job lot. So what? I remembered the footage after Rabin had been assassinated, and sure, I saw his niece, or whoever it was, speaking at his funeral. I understood that it must be sad, but I wasn't personally affected. To me, it was just one more dead person amongst the thousands on both sides in Israel who'd been bombed and shot over the years. I didn't get worked up about political murders, even when they were closer to home, which usually meant Northern Ireland. Fuck 'em. We all have to die sometime. Live by the sword and all that. They were all as bad as each other. For all I knew, there could be massive ramifications to whatever Sarah was involved in. This crew could be plotting the murder of thousands of people. Maybe the USA's fear of chemical or biological weapons being used in their backyard was becoming a reality here and now, in a holiday home in North Carolina. It would be quite easy to contaminate, say, the entire water supply of DC. Even if it was partial contamination, the right sort of disease would quickly spread itself around. Making one person history can often mean saving many others. It was simplistic. But I always saw such tease in terms of putting a round into Hitler's skull in 1939. I knew I was trying to keep emotions out by looking at it logically. Maybe the Americans had now been told what was going on and would be hitting the target as soon as they got sorted. In which case, it stood to reason that Elizabeth wouldn't want Sarah to be found on target. So, extract her. Drop her. Make sure she's never found. Who knows? I forced myself to cut away from conjecture. It had no bearing on the order I'd received. And I'd probably come to the wrong conclusion anyway. Either way, I just didn't want the job. I was watching the house through the misty rain in a sort of daydream. I gripped myself again. Fuck it. If I carried on thinking like this, I'd end up howling at the moon and dancing round the maypole, or whatever tree huggers do. Maybe I'd been reading too many books about kids and their emotions. Maybe all the touchy-feely crap was getting to me. I decided to bin it, get the tree-hugging cassette out of my head, and put the work one back in. Sarah might have lots of plans, but as far as I was concerned, long life wasn't going to be one of them. The rain was bucketing down. I pulled on the hood string, trying to stop the water running down my neck. I was getting very cold. I forced myself to focus on emission analysis and to look at the factors that could affect it. Only then could I carry out the task and have a chance of getting away with it. If I wanted to kill the President of the United States, nobody could stop me. But getting away with it would be the hard bit. The first thing I had to do was understand my mission. What was required of me? It broke down into just two parts. First, I had to get her out of the target area by 0500 hours tomorrow morning. The second part, the T-104 wasn't important at the moment. Besides, I already knew how I was going to do it. I broke down the first part of the job into five phases. 1. Approach the house. 2. Make entry. 3. Locate Sarah. 4. Lift and exfil from the house. 5. Exfil the area. Next, I had to look at what might stop me from carrying out those 5 phases. The first obstacle was obviously the men with her. There were far too many of them for comfort, and for all I knew, there could be even more inside who hadn't poked their heads out yet. What were their intentions? Fuck knows. It was a safe bet, though, that they weren't there for the canoeing. It looked as if the place was an RV point. At some stage, therefore, they were going to leave. And maybe that was the reason she had to be lifted before 5 o'clock in the morning, because they wouldn't all be staying together in one place for long. The next question. What were their tactics, training, leadership, and morale? I could only guess. Certainly their leadership would be good. Either Sarah would be in charge herself, or if she wasn't, then whoever was would have to cut the mustard or she wouldn't be working with them. As for their morale, that looked just fine. They seemed confident about what they were doing, whatever that was. 90% of people's confidence can come from total stupidity and no understanding of what's going on. And only 10% because they are well-trained and well-prepared. Sarah would only be in a group where confidence was backed up with ability. What were their capabilities? And did they have weapons? I had no idea. All I knew about was Sarah as a person and an operator. So I knew that she was professional, ruthless, focused, and capable of killing. If I got into the house and she saw me first, she'd kill me if she had to. She would fight rather than be taken. Strangely enough, that meant that I wasn't so worried about her because she was quantifiable. But the other guys, I didn't know if they would fight, and what with. I had to assume the worst. It always pays to assume that the other players are better than you are, and plan accordingly. I didn't have a lot of information to go on. But what was new about that? It wouldn't be the first time that I'd had to go into a situation blind. It just pissed me off that I'd positively ID'd her. Maybe it would have been better if I hadn't. Maybe. I found myself half hoping that everyone in the house would clear off in the next few hours. Then there would be nothing I could do but start on the trail again. I began to run through everything I'd seen so far, trying to think of something I'd forgotten. The subconscious is wonderful, because it never forgets what it has seen or heard. Every sight, sound, and fragment of perception is tucked away in there somewhere. All you've got to do is drag it out. Maybe, for example, I'd seen a weapon without actually realizing it. Nothing came to me. Now I had to look at the ground where I was going to carry out the mission. First of all, the general terrain, and that was of no concern because I was sitting on it. I could almost spit at the target. It wasn't as if I was heading into an area I'd never seen before. The one factor that did worry me was the vital ground, which in this case was the 15 meters this side of the house that I reckoned to be within range of the proximity sensors and lights. How was I going to approach the target, let alone penetrate it? I scanned all the doors and windows for any information that would help me make entry. I had seen through the binoculars that the lock on the garage side door was just an ordinary pin tumbler, inside a large knob handle, much like those on motel doors. Very common, and not difficult to defeat. The far bigger problem would be whether I could get near the lock in the first place, without the detectors going apeshit. I had a clear picture of what my mission was. I knew all that I could about the enemy at this stage. And I knew all that I could know about the target. Or as much as I could for the time being. Now what I needed to work out was time and space. How much time I had to do what I had to do. As I lay looking at the target, pushing my hair from my forehead as it was starting to act as a channel for the rain, I thought about the 5 phases and tried to work out plans for each one. I looked at the approach. I visualized all the different routes, as if I was sitting in comfort, looking at a monitor connected to a live feed camera, with someone who was moving along each possible approach in turn.